listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Thank you, Jim. And greetings. Oh, my. So much going on. We're going to have Bishop Council Ned's going to be with us a little later on in the program, and James Shirk from the Heritage Foundation. This should be entertaining. And Sam Brown, but interesting piece in, where was this published? The Financial Times. It's like, you know, so bang your head against the wall. I keep reading the Financial Times. About Sam Brownback and Kansas. And did you find that clip, by the way, Troy? No? Okay, you're still looking. Okay, let me know if you get it. And, or it might just be labeled JFK on taxes or something like that. But the point of this is that Sam Brownback was like, apparently, I mean, he was a, you know, United States Senator for quite some time, Republican. And the Republicans all give lip service to Reaganomics, to the idea that if you cut taxes on high income earners, that's going to be a wonderful thing for the economy. Now, this is a bill of goods that Ronald Reagan sold us in the 1980s when the top tax rate was above 50%. It was 74%. And the top 1%, basically, people making over about $500,000 a year. Up until that point, you know, they were paying 20, 30, 40, 50%. Above that point, they were paying 74% in income taxes. And so they'd say, yeah, well, you know, just cap my income at 30 times what the employees are making, kind of thing. You got it? So, Reagan came along and said, you know, with Arthur Laffer and the Laffer curve, where he said, you know, if taxes are 100%, no one would even work, because why work? Well, actually, the fact of the matter is a lot of people would work. A lot of people love their work. And if they didn't need the income and the taxes were not, they'd still work. But anyhow, Reagan had this bizarre logic. George Herbert Walker Bush called it voodoo economics in the primary in 1980. He said it was stupid and silly and it wouldn't work. And he was right. But Reagan became president and did it anyway. So Sam Brownback apparently really believed this. And he campaigned on, you know, 4 years ago on just massive tax cuts for rich people. Cutting welfare benefits for working people and poor people, cutting taxes for rich people and corporations, and quote, reducing state spending, cutting spending to education. Scott Walker, actually, in Wisconsin, I believe, has cut education more than any other governor in the history of the country. So here the Financial Times points out that instead, in the fiscal year to June, the state took in less than $338 million in revenue, less in revenues than it had projected, and $726 million less than it had collected the previous year. Gee, what a surprise. You cut taxes, you've taken less tax dollars. I mean, it's the same thing that happened during Reagan's presidency. Reagan tripled the national debt. He increased our national debt more than every other president before him, all the way back to George Washington, combined. But that, you know, that didn't seem to, like, no little reality trip here for Sam Brownback. Moody's and Standard & Poor's both downgraded Kansas's bonds. So this is, you know, this really interesting conversation that I think we're on the edge of having here, which would be a really important one to have, which is what should the top tax rate on really rich people be? The top story over at Huffington Post right now by Ben Walsh, economists say we should tax the rich at 90%. And they say all Americans, including the rich, would be better off if top tax rate, including the rich, would be better off if the top tax rates went back to Eisenhower era levels when the top federal income tax rate was 91%. Now, here's where it gets interesting. They point out currently it's at 39.6%. And you got to make more than $457,000 as a couple, or $406,000 as an individual before you start paying 39.6%. In other words, you only pay that on your income after your first $457,600. And they point out that's about 1.3 million people in America make that kind of money. Okay. And then Ben Walsh, and Ben, I, you know, if you get a chance to listen to this, I hope you do, he goes on to then repeat what has become one of the most pernicious of the Republican propaganda stories that has propagated across our political consciousness over the last few decades. You know, there's a bunch of them. You know, Al Gore said he invented the internet. He never said that. He actually said that he was proud to have co-sponsored and signed the legislation that started the internet. But, you know, some people think Al Gore said he invented the internet. Yeah, I mean, there's just a bunch of that, you know, had the vote in Florida actually been counted, George Bush would have still won. Nah, it turns out Bush would have lost. I mean, there's a bunch of these things that Republicans have spun over the years that people don't understand. And one of them is what Ben said in this article. He said, what you're seeing is decades of more or less rigid adherence to the gospel that tax cuts for the highest income earners are good. And then he says the trend began with President Kennedy. Well, it really didn't. And first of all, Kennedy did not lower taxes. It was LBJ who lowered the top tax rate from 91% to 74%. And, you know, he cited Kennedy. And Kennedy did propose lowering that top tax rate from 91 to 74%. But he proposed it as a way of increasing taxes on rich people. Now, keep in mind, Kennedy came from a multimillionaire family. He was a multimillionaire himself. He knew what rich people paid in taxes. And he knew that nobody was paying the 91% after it had been there 40 years and all kinds of Republicans had drilled all kinds of holes in it. The Democrats, too. And so what he was saying is he wanted to actually increase tax revenue, raise. And this wasn't the voodoo economics of Reagan where, you know, if we cut taxes, more money is going to come in. No, Kennedy said, we're going to cut the top tax rate because nobody's paying that, but we're going to enforce the 74% by closing all the loopholes. So this is going to produce more income for us because we're actually going to start taxing rich people. And here's Kennedy saying that. There's two pieces to the clip, right? Okay. So I want you to just listen. He says, we're going to increase revenues. And then at the very end, he points out how Richard Nixon has distorted his position. And I would say Republicans have been doing it ever since. Here's the first clip.
I think it's possible to gain $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
There you go. So, you know, these are the specific things he's going to do. Rich people are making all their money by, you know, withholding dividends and expense accounts and stuff like that. We're going to close these loopholes and we're going to increase the money coming into the government. This is the opposite of Reaganomics. And then Kennedy says, and here's how I'm going to spend that extra money.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
Yeah, the Republicans lie about where he stands. Surprise, surprise, but they still are. And I'm not suggesting that Ben Walsh is a Republican, and what I'm saying is that Republicans have been lying about Jack Kennedy for so many years that reporters are starting to think that those lies are true. Jack Kennedy did not lower taxes. He proposed tax changes that would have raised taxes on the rich. It actually would have raised taxes on the rich. And with that extra money, he was going to put more money into our schools, put more money into our transportation systems, put more money into housing, particularly for poor people. And he was pretty straightforward about it. So anyway, back to this research paper, it says, you know, if we go back to that 90% tax bracket, it will be good for the economy because it's going to drive income back down to the middle and lower income earners, which will raise their income. They'll spend more money, which will stimulate the economy because rich people making money does not stimulate the economy.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Sam Brownback has proven this. In Kansas, now we just need to kind of acknowledge it and say, hey, okay, Reaganomics has failed. And welcome back, Rick, the poet in New Haven, Connecticut, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind today?
How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
You know, I'm trying to figure something out. You know, I've been watching your program for a while. You know, first of all, I'm not a politician or a poet. I mean, a politician, I'm a poet, you know. But I've been trying to figure this thing out. You know, I've been watching your program for a while, And, you know, it seemed like to me that, you know, I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but somebody got to give me a little information. You know, police brutality, they beat people up in the street, they shoot people, they kill people, you know, and then they come in the communities and they want to, you know, want you to vote for them in the election. I mean, I'm trying to figure what the strategy is, you know?
Yeah. Well, the police brutality and elections, I think, are largely two separate issues, aren't they? I mean, police are not elected. What am I missing here?
I don't know.
I can tell you that, you know, the police brutality. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. The police, it's not just police brutality. It's like this whole kind of mindset that police have, particularly in white police and minority communities, of fear. And it's a racial fear. It's a class fear. And I think it's a fear that is stoked and perpetuated on a consistent, continuous basis by Fox News, right-wing talk radio, right-wing websites. Be afraid. Be afraid of Ebola. Be afraid of Muslims. Be afraid of people of color. Be afraid of, you know, it's just be afraid. This is the constant message. And so, anyway, I think that's infecting our police department. So there is, I suppose, some association between politics and this. Roxanne, watching Free Speech TV in Alloway, New Jersey. Hey, Roxanne, what's up?
Well, I was just watching The Secret of Oz by Bill Still, and I have read Ellen Brown's Web of Debt. I'm a member of the public banking group in New Jersey, and I think we need to consider how we could go back to the greenback of Andrew Jackson's time and President Lincoln's time and even Thomas Jefferson's time. I also have your book. I want to have a revolution every 30 years. I like that idea. I think it would be good for democracy, and I think all these things are starting to bubble up and bubble out. So I'm doing what you said. I'm getting out and getting active, and I thought I would call you.
Well, good. Thank you, Roxanne, for doing that. By the way, Jack Kennedy printed greenbacks also. He had $2 bills or $5 bills were printed during the Kennedy administration, and they have a red seal on them, and they are not Federal Reserve notes. They're Treasury notes. And it was an experiment that lasted just a couple of years, and LBJ put an end to it. And I never really did get the whole story on why and how, but I'm with you that we should bring the Fed under the aegis of the Treasury Department. They, you know, rather than the Fed and their private banks and everything making money on just, you know, the federal government right now can't even sell bonds without running them through these big banks. And it's bizarre. So.
I also was on YouTube, and I think I said The Secret of Oz. I recommend that to everyone who wants to watch because it goes all the way back into the earliest recorded times. It goes through Roman times, and it just is a really good explanation. I recommend Web of Debt by Ellen Brown.
Yeah, Ellen Brown's stuff is great. The Secret of Oz I can't speak to. I haven't seen it, but I'll check it out, Roxanne. Thank you for the recommendation, and thanks for being an activist and getting out there and doing it. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, Chris Christie came out and said Republicans need to win these state races, particularly governor's races. Why? So they can control the mechanism of voting. Seriously. Chris Christie, the head of the Republican Governors Association, just came right out and said it yesterday that Republicans, I mean, you know, the clear implication of what he was saying is that Republicans don't think they can win unless they can suppress the vote. And in those states where, like Texas, where you're going to have a very, very aggressive voter suppression going on in 2 weeks, odds are Republicans are going to win because they're going to suppress the vote of poor people. They're going to suppress the vote of young people. They're going to suppress the vote of old people. They're going to suppress the vote of people of color. And they know that this is very effective voter suppression. It's really quite remarkable. Really quite remarkable. So where do we go with this? What do we do with this? The Larry Beinhardt, I wrote a chapter about this in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. And there's also a fairly extensive discussion of this in my book, Threshold. We have tax policy for two purposes. There's two reasons why we have tax policies. And the most important of those two reasons is not to raise revenue for the federal government. That's something the taxes do. And it's an important thing the taxes do. When Sam Brownback cut taxes on rich people in Kansas, Kansas took in less money. In fact, Kansas is nearly broke right now because of Sam Brownback's Reaganomics experiment there, just like the United States is now, quote, broke or at least badly in debt because of 34 years of a Reaganomics experiment here in the United States, you know, nationwide. But the most important reason why you have tax policy is not to raise money. It's to alter behavior. Government actually does modify behavior. There are behaviors that we want to encourage, and there are behaviors that we want to discourage. And this isn't, you know, some group of liberals or conservatives, for that matter, sitting in an ivory tower saying, oh, gee, you know, we should do this or that. But it's just the practical stuff. You know, what is the appropriate role of government? What should we be doing? And how do we encourage that kind of, and what kind of behaviors do we want? We want fewer people to smoke tobacco. Back 40 years ago, cigarettes were, you know, 20, 30, 40 cents a pack. Now they're $4, $5, $6, whatever they are. They're very expensive. Why? Because, hey, 400 to 500,000 Americans die every year because of tobacco. So you want to reduce the number of people doing that. How do you do it? You raise the taxes on it. It's fairly straightforward. One of the other things that we don't want people doing is gambling with hot money. Because when people, and by gambling, I'm talking about gambling on the stock market, gambling in the housing market, gambling in the derivatives market. When rich people find that after the first $400,000 a year, which they can get at a fairly low tax rate, after that, the top tax rate goes up above 50%. And this is the research that Larry Beinhart did, that he's been on this program a couple of times talking about. It's just brilliant stuff. What happens when you have that low top tax rate? When the people at the very top are not paying a lot of taxes, so they can easily pull money out of their businesses, out of their corporations, like the head of, you know, United Healthcare making over $1 billion, right? Two of the last two presidents, the last two CEOs. What happens is then they start taking that money and saying, you know, it wasn't hard to get this $100 million. So instead of putting it in a safe investment, in a conservative investment, in a cautious investment, I'm going to throw caution to the wind because, hey, easy come, easy go. And invest it in high-risk bonds or invest it in derivatives or give it to hedge fund managers, you know, things that have a potential upside of, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40% return in a year. In a year when, you know, if you simply put it in the bank, you might get 1.5%. You know, I'm going to do that instead of something more cautious. And the result of that always, in every country around the world, with a large enough economy to have their own stock markets, always is that when taxes on the really rich are above 50%, you have periods, long-term periods of economic stability and market stability and banking system stability. And when the top tax rate drops below 50%, and once again, John Kennedy never suggested it should go below 50%. When the top tax rate goes below 50%, then what you have is bubbles and bursts, boom and bust, boom and bust, boom and bust. These cycles that tend to run 6, 8, 10, 12-year cycles of, you know, it's how long it takes to inflate a bubble and then to collapse a bubble and then to inflate another bubble and then collapse a bubble. And so we have been seeing since the Reagan tax cuts went into place, we saw the dot-com bubble. First, we saw a bubble in the S&L industry, and then that burst. There was the biggest stock market crash in 1987 during the Reagan administration in the history of the United States, other than the one that led up to the Great Depression. There was a big stock market crash as a consequence of this. And then we went into the 90s and we had the dot-com bubble, and that popped in 2000. And then we had, and so then, you know, hey, it wasn't a stock market bubble anymore. Now it was a real estate bubble. because Phil Graham had deregulated banking. And so the banksters could take real estate mortgages and take $1 million worth of mortgages and turn it into $1 trillion worth of derivatives by betting on betting on betting. And so, you know, a few billion dollars or a few $100 billion worth of, you know, really bad mortgages, bad paper, became the basis, the value, the underlying value out of which was derived these bets. They're called derivatives because they derive their value from something underneath them. So we had $800 trillion worth of derivatives going into the great crash in 2008. $800 trillion. Keep in mind, the GDP of the entire planet is $65 trillion. The GDP of the United States is $15 trillion. We had $800 trillion worth of derivatives. All funny money. Why? Because who's going to buy this stuff? People whose top tax rate is low and whose income is high. That's why we need to change the top tax rate.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We need to just acknowledge it. Reaganomics has been a spectacular failure. It has destroyed America. It's time to repeal it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, well, this should be entertaining. Bill in Fontana, California. It says that you want to debate or disagree with me about raising income taxes on the very rich above 50%. Make your case, sir.
Well, I think there is a reason to look at incentive to work, and our tax rates probably now for at 39% are probably about right, because you have to add in state taxes, and
which don't exist in Texas and Florida.
Right, but they probably should. Because what you got is a situation where a lot of our income tax revenue for states comes from sales taxes. Now, sales taxes cost sales because people try to avoid them. I used to work in an industry where we did a lot of online sales. Right. And we had all our biggest sellers did nothing but sell out of state. They never sold in their own state because that way they didn't collect sales tax.
Right.
I realize there is use tax and the states are starting to enforce it. But I would say that we ought to move away from sales tax on the states and move more towards income taxes, and that we should look at a situation and say the total tax rate should not be so high that it discourages people.
Now, Bill. Stop for a second. We had a top income tax rate of 91% from the 1930s until the 1960s, and over 50% from the 1930s to the 1980s. So let's use that 50 years, from the 1930s to the 1980s. We had a period of sustained prosperity, and on top of that, you had wealthy people, CEOs, on average earning only 30 times what their workers made. Now, you know, when Reagan came into office, the largest employer in the United States was General Motors, and GM was paying its employees, in today's dollars, $54 an hour, which, by the way, is what the German average industrial wage is right now. Today, now, after 34 years of Reaganomics and this giant cut in taxes at the top, the CEO of General Motors and all these other CEOs, instead of making 30 times what their workers make, and instead of even living in the same neighborhoods as their workers, as they used to, there's a great piece in Forbes back in the 70s about meet the CEO next door, you know, how they may have two cars instead of one, but that's, you know, the big difference. Instead, now the CEOs live in a world apart. They have their private helicopters and their private jets and their private dining room with all the help because it's all tax deductible because we changed our tax code to help those guys out. And they're living in a separate world, and now our largest employer is Walmart, and they're paying, you know, in the neighborhood of $10 an hour, less than $10 an hour, on average, instead of $50 an hour. It's like, this is the consequence of tax policy.
No, I don't think it is the consequence of tax policy. I think it's the consequence of the decline of unions.
Well, to some extent, it's a consequence of trade policy also. But
I agree with that too.
But the simple reality is that if somebody, you know, your beginning premise was you don't want to discourage work. I don't want to discourage work either. I can't imagine anybody who would say, you know, my first $500,000 was taxed at 35%, and so, you know, that's fine. Or even 40%. Actually, the first 100,000 was, because here's how it works. You know, your first 30 or 40,000 is tax free, and then your next $50,000 or $60,000 is taxed at 10%, and then the next $50,000 or $60,000 is taxed at 20%. And as you make more and more, your tax goes up on that incremental piece. Most people don't realize this is how progressive taxation works. But Bill Gates pays zero income taxes on his first, you know, $10,000-$12,000, whatever the poverty wage is, you know, whatever the, just like everybody else.
I understand.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. I understand what you're saying.
Why not say, you know, if you want to earn over a $500,000, good luck, but you're going to pay 80% or 90% income taxes on it. And at that point, people just say, okay, I'm going to cap my income at $400,000, $500,000 a year and not pay that 90% income tax and use that money to pay my employees.
In a lot of ways, that's what did happen when we had the 90%.
That's exactly what did happen.
Except that what they did was they would buy tax shelters that were oftentimes not really economically a good idea, but it took their tax rate down.
Well, that's what Kennedy wanted to undo.
And in fact, he did to some extent.
Yeah.
And I think we should undo a lot of those shelters that have re-risen and do rise every few years, and that would be a good idea.
Yeah.
And you know, we probably
but here's the simple math,
right.
Bill. When you look at not just the United States but other countries as well, and I encourage you to look back at these articles that I've written about this, Larry Beinhart has written about this, and others have written about it. When the top tax rate, income tax rate, federal income tax rate, you know, yes, you're right. States add things onto that, and there's other things get added onto that. But when that top tax rate is above 50%, things stabilize. When it's below 50%, things are extremely unpredictable and volatile economically. And that, I think, you know, we should just you can't not acknowledge those numbers. And we've seen this in country after country, and we've seen it in the United States. We've had a top tax rate that was over 90% a couple of times. I mean, we had one during World War I as well, and things stabilized all of a sudden. It was quite remarkable. And then Harding came in 1920 and dropped the top tax rate from 91% down to 25% in 1921. And what did that do? It kicked off the bubble that led to the burst of 1929.
Well, I would say that the tax rate was secondary to ignoring the economy, ignoring the farm depression that never ended after 1920, ignoring the real estate bust that came in 1926 by Coolidge. I mean, he basically followed a, as you say, a libertarian policy of I'm not going to get involved in anything.
Right.
He knew, he's quoted as saying, Hoover's going to get a depression and he's never going to know what to do with it, which unfortunately was the case. But, you know, I think right now we tax people who are making under $100,000 too much. We probably should cut those rates.
I agree.
We should remove the cap on FICA. And that, by the way, takes you over 50%. And cut sales tax and increase state income tax, because the states are not in good shape either.
Yeah, I agree with all those things. I'm just saying that at the federal level, the top tax rate needs to go above 50%. History demonstrates it works best when it's above 50%.
Well, I think what you're – but the problem is there isn't – the top tax rate is a combination of – a number of things.
No, I'm talking about the federal, the very simple top federal tax rate.
Yeah, but I don't think you can do that. I think you have to look at the total tax rate. And if you're saying a federal tax rate of 90% in California, that almost puts you over a 100% tax rate that people have to pay.
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is that state taxes are tax deductible at the federal level, so you know that's not going to happen. But I guess, you know, we're not going to convince each other. Bill, I check out this Economists Say We Should Tax the Rich at 90% article that Ben Walsh wrote over at Huffington Post. I think you'll find it interesting. I'm going to move along. Bill, thank you for the call. Van in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Hey, Van, what's up?
Oh, thank you for having me. Just a couple of points. You've been talking today. The Republicans have always screamed about the debt, the climbing debt, and, you know, they kind of fail to realize or remember that it was Nixon that got us off the gold standard. And, you know, back in the days when you couldn't pile up any more debt than you had gold to back it up.
Well, not true. Not true. We ran up an enormous debt, for example, in the late 30s, early 40s, fighting World War II. We were at 127% of GDP. We owed more money than we made every year. And by the time World War II was over, and we were on the gold standard at that time, we just sold bonds.
Yeah, but see, being
on the gold standard does not prevent you from going into debt. Yeah. And the problem with the gold standard is that if your economy grows and you don't want your dollar to be deflated, you have to acquire more gold to have the same, you know, to have the number of dollars. You know, if the economy grows by 2%, your money supply needs to grow by 2%. And if you're on the gold standard, that means that you've got to increase your gold collection, your gold stocks by 2%, which can be very, very expensive. And the gold standard is not a panacea. In fact, it was a problem for this country. Nixon taking us off the gold standard was a good thing, in my opinion.
And then the other point was that, you know, a lot of people are under the impression that the Fed is actually a government entity. You know, it's sort of a quasi-government entity, but it's really kind of run by the banks, I would
say. It is, yeah. The chairman is selected, or the chairwoman in this case, is selected by the president and nominated. But it was
my impression that the only reason they named it the Federal Reserve is to make it more palatable to the American people.
I think you're right.
I think it was the government.
I think you're right, and I have a lot of problems with the Fed. I'm with Bernie Sanders on this thing. You know, that the Fed needs to be operating transparently. I think that we do need a central bank. I think, you know, I'm with Alexander Hamilton on that, actually. But it needs to operate transparently, and it should be under the Department of the Treasury. We should be issuing our own currency rather than having banksters issue our currency. And, you know, I'm with you on that. Van, thanks a lot for the call. But trust me, the gold standard is no panacea. The gold standard does not help. The gold standard might be useful if you're a small country in a competitive world and you don't have a strong economy and you don't have a strong identifiable base of assets to define the value of your currency. But for the United States, we don't need the gold standard. We really don't. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, being on the gold standard is a very, very clear negative for the United States. It was. Good thing we're not. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Chip watching Free Speech TV in Jackson, Mississippi. Hey, Chip, what's up?
Hi. Just wanted to clarify something. I didn't realize Al Gore never did say he didn't invent the Internet.
No, he never said that.
I don't think Sarah Palin ever said she could see Russia from her house either, did she?
No, she didn't. She said you could see it from Alaska.
Oh, she could see her. Okay. Just want to be fair and balanced. But anyway, about the taxes, I really feel like the problem here in this country is that half the country pays no income tax. Don't you think that is an extreme issue that we need to look at?
And you could easily fix that by raising the minimum wage.
Well, that's true. But what's the unemployment rate?
Well, the unemployment rate is a whole separate issue. The problem that we have right now is, or one of the really serious problems we have as a country, is that there is this new business model that was created by the fast food industry and the retail industry, you know, the basically the Walmart industry, which is, you know, internalize profits, externalize expenses, right? You dump the cost, as much of the cost as you possibly can of doing business, onto the taxpayers. So Walmart comes into a community and says, we're going to open a store, but we want free land. We want a 20-year tax abatement. We want, you know, cash up front, in tax money. And states and counties and cities give them all these, you know, tax breaks and all this other stuff. And then their business model is, we're going to pay people little enough, which means below $10.10 an hour. We're going to pay them little enough that even if they work full time, they qualify for food stamps, they qualify for housing support, they qualify for free medical care, Medicaid. So we don't have to pay them well enough that they can basically live in the United States because of the welfare state that has, you know, that exists in this country. And that's the need to have a welfare state is not I don't think, something we can dispute. So if we're going to have that, then it should be calibrated such that people, if they're working full time, they no longer qualify for welfare. And but that's very easily done. Raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, and you're going to see millions of people who right now at $7.25 an hour qualify for welfare and are working full time. $10.10 an hour, they no longer qualify for welfare. So billions of dollars, in hundreds of billions of dollars in money that is going to subsidize McDonald's and Walmart, right, and everything, by subsidizing their employees, that's no longer going to be available to those employees. The employers are going to have to pay for that, which is how an economy is supposed to work. It's not supposed to be that my tax dollars are subsidizing Walmart and McDonald's.
Well, Tom, what incentive do people have to go out and work for $10 an hour when they can get more in benefits, you know, from the
government? They can't.
They do. They get free housing.
You are echoing the whole Fox News conservative Republican thing.
No, I've seen
there are
actually people.
Look at the
interview that Nancy Pelosi's daughter did on the streets of New York. Pull it up on YouTube and look at that. They do not want to work for that. They would rather just be on the dole. Many of them. Now, many people do want to work, and they should be. You know, they've got families and, you know, they do that, but it's not just a black and white issue here, you know, no pun intended, but it's just...
I'm not saying it is. What I am saying, Chip, is that if you want to blow up this business model, this business model of let's have the public pay for 20-30% of the cost of our employees, if you want to end that, you do that by raising the minimum wage. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John in Portland, Oregon. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, let me take you off speaker real quick.
Thank you.
How are you doing today? I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I absolutely love your show.
Thanks.
I've been listening since way back in the Air America days when I lived in Los Angeles. The reason I was calling is yesterday you were talking about the millennials. I happen to be a millennial. I just turned 33 the other day, so I just barely slide into the cusp. But I've always worked for small businesses my whole life, and I can't quite make ends meet, but I'm always at the $12 to $15, sometimes even as high as $17 an hour range. But all that really does for me is it brings me up to about $30,000 a year, and my income tax rate is at about 21%, right, which is just an unlivable wage. I can't figure out how to make ends meet on that. And I think where the millennials come in is we get a little disenfranchised in that when you start talking about such large numbers, yeah, we could tax the rich at above 50 or 60% or even push them closer to the 90%. But unless that increases my wage at closer to the $20 or $21 an hour range, and unless my income taxes fall at about 17%, I still can't make ends meet.
Right. I agree. And I think that it's crazy that we're taxing people who are making under $30,000 a year anything at all. And this
Absolutely.
Is somebody earlier called and
when,
said,
when it comes to voting, who do we vote for that's even going to take such a thing in consideration?
Yeah. Anybody who's a member of the Progressive Congressional Caucus, you've got about, you know, 90 members of the House, and you've got a couple of members in the Senate, Bernie Sanders, Sherrod Brown. In Oregon, you've got Ron Wyden, and who's the other guy who's your senator?
Merkley.
Jeff Merkley. Thank you. Yeah, Jeff Merkley's a good progressive.
Merkley's good. I just cast my ballot for him recently. Fortunately, we get a vote early here, and we can actually look at our ballots as we vote. So I've already cast that and filled it out.
Right.
But even still, I have those two senators in an entire House that just really has no concern for those of us who.
But
make
see, what John,
race.
What you're describing is the echo of Reaganomics. Reagan doubled taxes on working people, and he increased taxes on working people a total of 13 times during his presidency. He radically cut taxes on rich people. It went from 74% down to 28%. Capital gains rate went from 28% down to 15%. Reagan made
I'm well aware of Reagan.
And that's still going on.
Victim of Reagan arguments.
My point is
I'm well aware. I grew up in California. I don't get to go to college as a result of Reagan either.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, what we need to do is just acknowledge that Reaganomics has been a horrible failure. And we need to cut taxes on working people, and we need to raise taxes on people who earn their income sitting around the pool on their butts waiting for the dividend check to arrive.
I agree with all that. But
really simple.
Who is actually going to put themselves forward to do such a thing, and how do we actually make any progress towards that?
I again, I think your progressive politicians get this. And increasingly, I mean, look at what's happening in Kansas right now, where Sam Brownback doubled down on Reaganomics and broke his state. Broke it so badly, even Moody's and Standard & Poor's saying, sorry, you know, your credit rating stinks. They're you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in debt right now because he cut taxes on rich people. And guess what? Reduced tax income. John, thank you for the call. I get what you're saying, and I agree with your point. Michael in Chicago. Hey, Michael.
I just wanted to get your opinion on the fact that I think that we're living in a depression right now, just in disguise, the way the money's separated.
I agree. In fact, that's the essence of my book, The Crash of 2016, is that the crash of 2006, 2007, 2008 never went away. And okay,
I do make, you know, that $10, $11, and I make just enough to survive. I have no choice but to spend my money to survive. Where the people that make plenty of money to survive, they have plenty of choice to, oh, do I want to go buy a car? Oh, do I want a boat? Or do I want to sit on this money and send it to an offshore account?
Right. Yeah. You know? Yeah. No, I agree. And, Michael, thank you for the call. Clav in Shelton, Washington, listening on KMAS. Hey, Clav, what's up? Or Clay, excuse me.
Oh yeah, this is me. I'm Clay. Yeah. Not to be confused with my brother Claude.
Okay, what's up, Clay?
I heard you talking earlier about President Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
and his economic plan versus Nixon's and versus Reaganomics in general. And I want to hear more about Kennedy and his. His plan. I mean, really.
Well, he laid it out very clearly, and yeah, if you still have that clip up, we can play it again here, and I think because it's worth playing again because there is this mythology which is now being recited by reporters like Ben Walsh that Kennedy was a Reaganomics guy, that he believed in supply side theory because he wanted to drop the top tax rate, which is not true. He wanted to close loopholes at the top tax rate so that rich people actually started paying taxes again. And here's what he had to say in 1960 in his debate with Richard Nixon.
I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
There you go. So this is, he was going to close these loopholes. And then he says, and with this extra money that we're going to get, and this isn't the magic extra money that Reagan talked about. If we drop taxes on rich people, we'll take in more money, which never happened. We dropped taxes on rich people and Reagan tripled the national debt over 8 years. And the same thing that Sam Brownback did in Kansas. But Kennedy says, if we actually raise taxes on rich people, here's how he's going to use the money.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
And it's a shame that the public record has been so distorted over the years. And that's what LBJ did in 1964, using the assassination of Kennedy as the, you know, do this in John's memory thing. They dropped the top tax rate from 91% to 74%, and then they closed up a lot of those loopholes, and rich people started paying taxes, and tax revenues went up. Tragically, LBJ then used that money for the war in Vietnam. Well, he used a lot of it for the Great Society, too. But, sure. You know, so got it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure you would appreciate that.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Clay. Thanks for the call. What's our time right now? 10 seconds, okay. Yeah, it's not enough time to bring him up. But this is the next time you hear some Republican or some conservative say, oh, yeah, Kennedy, just like Reagan, he wanted to drop taxes on rich people. No, not true. As Kennedy says, I just want to be on the record. Mr. Nixon misstates my position constantly. Yeah, Republicans have a way of doing that. But here's where I stand. And we are looking at the evisceration, the devastation of the American middle class as a consequence of 34 years of Reaganomics. It's time to say the experiment is over, it failed, and go back to an economic system that works.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and in the studio with me, Bishop Council Ned II, a founding member of Project 21, chairman of In God We Trust, National Center p21index.org is the website, nationalcenter.org/p21index.html. But we'll have a link to it over at tomhartman.com. You can find it. Nice to see you again.
Thanks for having me on again.
Thanks for joining us. We have this story here by Todd Sarnes in at Fox News that two Christian ministers who own an Idaho wedding chapel have said that they are concerned. Nobody's actually threatened to prosecute them, and the government has not said that they're going to, but the Alliance Defending Freedom is representing Donald and Evelyn Knapp, two ordained ministers who own the Hitching Post Wedding Chapel in Coeur d'Alene in Idaho. And their lawyer, Jeremy Tedesco, says right now they're at risk of being prosecuted, the threat of enforcement. And the reason why is because they're saying, yeah, we run a wedding chapel and we don't want to marry gay people. What's wrong with saying to somebody, and by the way, their business is incorporated as a for-profit business, which means that they have to comply with anti-discrimination laws. What's wrong with saying if you're going to run a for-profit business, you can't discriminate against people?
Well, honestly, I think there is probably not a problem with that. I think that's where this gentleman gets into trouble. If he's running some sort of for-profit religion sort of thing, I personally have an issue with that. You know, I was ordained to the priesthood in 1998, became bishop 2005. And, you know, in that time, I guess maybe 14 people have asked me to do their weddings. Mm-hmm. I've refused all but two of them. And the reason why I don't like to do weddings is I think people take the sacrament lightly. And, you know, if I'm not convinced that, you know, this is the right thing or that this marriage is going to last, then, you know, I think I'm well within my right to say, you know what, I'm not the right person to do this. But the fact is, you know, of the only two of the people that I refuse to marry are actually still married now. Mm. And so I think that's sort of telling about sort of the way we view marriage and the way we handle this sort of thing. But I think he's getting into a tricky situation. He's setting himself up for dispute. He's setting himself up for lawsuits. He's setting himself up for a number of things on a variety of different levels, whether it's dealing with, quote unquote, the law of God and having this sort of for-profit chapel. But also, you know, he's setting himself up for a conflict with the state. You know, if he's got a business, a for-profit business, then, you know, if he wants to operate under Caesar's rules, he needs to operate under Caesar's rules.
Right. So you're agreeing with me, essentially, that if he's going to run a for-profit business, he has to comply with non-discrimination laws.
Well, yes, I think he needs to apply with non-discrimination laws. You know, to put it in a different context, you know, he can't say, well, I'm not going to marry blacks.
Right.
If you're running a for-profit business. But,
interracial marriage up until the 70s.
In Virginia, yes.
Yeah, was illegal.
Right.
As Barack Obama pointed out, his mother and father could not have been married in Virginia when he was born. So where is the concern? Where is our conversation here?
Well, I think our conversation, our usual conflict, would probably be in the broader issue of, you know, looking at the case of what's going on in Houston, where you've got the mayor saying that she wanted to see everybody's sermons that have to do with gay marriage or gay issues, and then she then backtracked from that position. I think that there needs to be.
I think that's an overstatement of what the mayor said.
I don't think it's an overstatement. She certainly modified her position after sort of all the outrage sort of showed up and appeared on her doorstep.
I think that, you know, Fox is so good at creating these victim stories, and that was a classic one. That there's no there. There's a lot of Sturm und Drang, but there's no there. This had to do with are you complying with state and federal laws that say that.
It's up to the mayor of Houston to decide whether you're complying with state and federal laws with regard to what goes on in churches that happen to be in the city of Houston.
If you're going to maintain your tax exemption and not pay taxes to the city of Houston, the city of Houston has a right to know if you're operating legally.
But the church still has the church operates on a higher authority, certainly higher than.
Well, then let them pay taxes.
Why?
Because they're using if your church is going to use my tax dollars for your police protection, for your fire protection, for the roads that bring people to your church, for the education so people can sit in the pews and sing the song along with you and know how to read. If my tax dollars are going to subsidize your church should operate.
But hold on. But the church
as a church,
the tax dollars aren't
not as a political agency.
The taxes aren't subsidizing the church.
Of course they are.
No, let's start. No, that's not that's a faulty syllogism.
If you're a 501c3 church, you don't pay property taxes.
I'm not getting a check from the government to say, here, council, here, go run your church the way you think is appropriate.
You absolutely
are. But the fact is, if somebody comes to me and says, council, you have to marry this person, I don't have to do anything. You know, yes, you can maybe file some criminal charges against me. You can sue me, but you can't make me marry somebody that I'm not.
No, I'm not suggesting anybody should.
The mayor of Houston was not looking at that.
The mayor of Houston was looking for prohibited political activity, if my recollection is correct. But
I think she was looking for a media headline.
It could be. But that's not the point in case here. The point in case here is whether religions should be allowed to discriminate, and if so, how and where. And I think that even if we're talking about not-for-profit, if we're talking about churches, yeah, of course, you can say to somebody, no, I don't want to marry you. But that's a different thing than saying to somebody, you don't want to marry them because of their race or because of their gender or because of their sexual orientation, those kind of things. And, you know,
why isn't that as good of a criteria for me as a minister to use as I don't think this marriage is going to last, or I think this marriage is sort of mocking God? There's no difference. You know, I'm given a wide discretion as to who I can lay hands on when I ordain them, who I can join together in holy matrimony.
Right.
And, you know, it's up to me. They can easily find somebody else who can do it. There's no shortage of people who can do these sorts of services.
I understand your point.
But I can't be compelled or made to do it.
But if you want me to subsidize you.
Mm-hmm. But you're not subsidizing me. You know,
I certainly am.
My parish needs a new roof right now. I can't go to State College, Pennsylvania, or even the governor of Pennsylvania and say, hey, I need money for a new roof.
No, you're not subsidizing me. But you are not paying property taxes, are you?
We are not paying property taxes.
Okay, I am subsidizing you.
No, you are not subsidizing.
Or at least the people of your community are subsidizing.
See, that's crazy logic. Just because I'm holding on, you know, our parish is holding on to our money, and because everybody else in this room has to give money to the government in some way, that doesn't mean that the church is being subsidized.
You're in a community. You're using the services of that community. You're not paying for the services of that community. That means this community is subsidizing you. And if the community is subsidizing you, they should have the right to say, and here are the conditions on which you want to operate. And I personally would have a problem with that. You know, I was ordained in 1972. Mm-hmm. I've done six weddings over the years.
Right.
And I don't want to get into the whole thing about me, but anyhow, I was a pastor of a church for 2 years in Detroit and in the early 70s. And I think that it's, you know, I understand running as a not-for-profit. Mm-hmm. I think frankly, if we're going to have not-for-profit for religious organizations, it should be limited to monasteries, because a monastery has no way to make money. And I think that monasteries are and both genders are actually good things. I think they're like beacons of light in the world, but they have no way to make money. So therefore, you know, they can't. You know, but if you want to have a church and you want to particularly engage in political activity, mm-hmm. pay taxes.
Well, engaging in political activity, that's a whole another issue.
Well, deciding who you're going to marry for reasons other than religious reasons is engaging in political activity.
Who said it's for other than religious reasons?
Okay.
You know, there's this book called The Bible, and it has some specific guidelines in there and general guideposts that clergy are supposed to use when determining who you're going to perform a ceremony for.
Well, and I get that. I mean, if you're going to marry people who are in the same religion as you, you know,
I can give you a long list of people that I don't marry, and I can give you a long list of reasons why I don't marry certain people under certain circumstances.
Of course.
But the state doesn't get to come in and tell me what to do. Yeah. You can punish me, you can fine me, you can do whatever you want, but you can't make me do something I don't want to do.
I think that's not unreasonable. No. And in fact, that's the law, that's the way things are. But I'm taking an even more radical position here, saying, you know, if you really don't want the state to tell you what to do, then pay your taxes.
There are no taxes for the church to pay.
Okay. Bishop Council Ned II, hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Founding member of Project 21, chairman of In God We Trust, nationalcenter.org is the website. And thank you for being with us today.
Thanks a lot.
It's always good to see you. We'll be back. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tom in Tucson, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on the website on 2mfreespeech.org. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Tom, there are 400 families in America that are multi-billionaires. If each of those 400 families, with no strings attached whatsoever, They're not expecting anything in return except maybe a prayer before we go to bed at night. Each of those 400 multi-billionaire families contributes $1 billion to the federal government. That's $400 billion to be used to treat 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, hard, hardcore, unemployed, poor people who have terrible sicknesses.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's my suggestion.
All right. I think it's a fine suggestion. I think that we should also tax wealth in addition to income. And thank you for the call, Tom. In the last hour, I was talking about taxing income. Well, there's a difference between wealth and income. Wealth is what you have. Income is what you get every year. So, you've got people like Paris Hilton who were born with wealth. Jack Kennedy, born with wealth. And then they used that wealth to generate income. They are the true capitalists. There's a very few actual capitalists in the United States. Probably just a few tens of thousands. People who actually make a living by investing their money at their capital, and then the money comes back on that, from that capital. And capitalists pay a different tax rate than everybody else. They pay a different tax rate than working people. Working people can pay up to 39.6%. Capitalists pay a maximum of 20% on their income. It's called the capital gains rate. And so, number one, I would suggest that the tax on capitalists, if anything, should be higher than the tax on working people. We need to reverse this because we don't need to encourage people to be investing. We need to encourage people to be working, right? Number one. And people will invest no matter what. They're going to invest in order to get a return. And regardless of the terms or conditions, regardless of the tax base and the tax rates, there are always people who are going to use their money to make money. But number two, I suggest that we have a tax on wealth and that it kick in after $1 billion. Your first $1,000 million, I mean, you can make $1 million 1,000 times with no tax that you now own. Right. I mean, this earning it, I shouldn't say you can make it with no tax, but you can have it. You can own it. You could have inherited it in the Walton family, the five heirs of the Walton family collectively, the richest person in the world if they were all just one person. The Koch brothers, number two, inherited their money from Daddy Koch. So if you've got $1 billion or more, I think everything beyond $1 billion should be taxed at 100%. If you can't live on $1 billion, you got a problem. And that would just go a huge way toward cleaning up the inequality that we have in our society. Anyway, just my proposal. We have a website, actually, nobillionaires.com. You can check that out. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Should we tax the rich? Should we tax the churches? Should we say to Bishop Council Ned, hey, buddy, cough up. The elimination of taxes on churches, by the way, is really relatively new. This was something Lyndon Johnson did when he was president. And it was 64, 65, right around that time. And it was a deal that he cut with the churches to stay out of politics. And basically what he said was, we will modify the Internal Revenue Service code to give you tax-exempt status if you don't participate in politics, if you stick to religion. And for a couple of years, for a decade or so, the churches stuck with that. And then, during the Reagan presidency, there was this outreach to these, quote, faith community, these very bizarre, corrupt people like Ralph Reed got into this thing, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, a billionaire who made his money with religion, got into the business, basically, of religion, and then said, hey, we need to get politics in this, too. And it's wrong, in my opinion. David in Addison, Illinois. Hey, David, what's up?
Yo, hey, so I actually jumped into the very end of what you were just talking about, and you were talking about how
we subsidize the churches, and therefore, to some degree, they should be beholden to our will as consumers or whatever it is. I think that's absolutely ridiculous. If we're going to follow through with your logic, then I'm subsidizing every person who's poorer than me, and I should be able to exert my will over their choices and their actions in a very, very serious way. Why do you think that that is in any way a fair characterization? And to go further on your point,
I think it's a false analogy.
Let me just
poor people are not running a business.
Okay.
When you start running a business in this country, you are given a whole set of protections and benefits that you don't have if you're just a poor person, and the the limitations of liability. All kinds of things that you can spend money on that normal people, if they spend money on it, has to be after-tax money. You can use pre-tax money for meals, for travel, for entertainment, for marketing, for all kinds of stuff. And so it's not a valid analogy.
I think it is, and you're just taking it a step less. If you just have to take it a step further, regular citizens spend tons of pre-tax money on things that are deductible. The mortgage deduction. More importantly, poor people have huge access to all kinds of programs and benefits that neither rich people nor businesses have access to. Welfare, Medicare, or Medicaid.
Okay, but David, to use your point that if those poor people want those resources, they have to dance to our tune. They do. Right now it's John Kasich in Ohio. He's going to knock 35,000 people off the food stamp rolls because he's saying you have to spend 20 hours a week looking for work or you don't qualify for food stamps. Even if you've got kids at home, you've got to get out there, leave those kids alone, whatever. I mean, we put all kinds of restrictions on people to get welfare benefits, radical restrictions.
Okay.
Pee in the cup.
So following your logic, that's all of those radical restrictions are acceptable because we're subsidizing them, correct?
By and large, sure.
Okay. So like the $20 a week looking for work is fair in your mind, right?
I don't think it's fair. I personally disagree with it, but I would not disagree with the argument that it is an appropriate function of the state to determine, if they're going to subsidize somebody, what the terms and conditions would be under which that they would offer that subsidy. I think, I don't always get my way, but we live in a democracy and a democratic republic. And just because I don't always get my way doesn't mean I don't think that the system, is a reasonably good system.
That's fine. The other thing I kind of wanted to look at here is you keep talking about how taxes and differing tax rates are subsidizing people. So would you be fine with a flat tax?
No.
Why not? That effectively eliminates the subsidy for anyone because then everyone is paying the same percentage.
Yeah, but everyone doesn't pay the same percentage. First of all,
well, what I'm saying is let's make everyone pay the same percentage. Let's make it a flat tax. Everyone pays 25% across the board. And then we have more than enough money to fund every program in the United States, and you can no longer claim that we have a subsidy.
You actually won't have more than enough money, because what's going to happen is as you raise taxes on working people, they're going to have less and less money to spend, which is going to kill your economy. And as you lower taxes on the very, very wealthy people, which is what you're suggesting with a flat tax, you're going to also kill the economy, because they're going to put more of that money into savings and investments and less of it into spending. A flat tax, as opposed to a progressive income tax, is an economy killer. That's why I'm opposed to it, in addition to being just wildly unfair.
Well, I disagree with it being wildly unfair.
Somebody who's earning $1 million a year is using the resources of our country much more aggressively than someone who's earning $10,000 a year. They're using our court system to enforce their contracts. They're using our air system for their travel. Just the fact that they're generating that kind of money. They're using our banking system. It's a more heavy use of the commons. They should pay more for that.
Well, they do pay more.
Yeah, well, they do, and that's what I'm saying. Okay, I get it. With your flat tax, they would increase it. Flat taxes don't work. That's my main objection to them, aside from the moral one, is a pragmatic one. Flat taxes don't work. Great example, case in point, Social Security should be a flat tax.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it's not. Instead, the rich people gamed Social Security to say, everybody who's working, everybody who makes under $118,000, they pay Social Security taxes, but rich people, nah, we don't pay it. This is interesting. Tom Tillis is changing his tune. Joan McCarter reporting over at the Daily Kos. One of the Toms out there who spells his name right. What a difference a tight poll in a general election made. This guy's a Republican. He's a Tea Party Republican. He's the Speaker of the House in North Carolina. Now he's running for the United States Senate against Kay Hagan, the Democrat who is the incumbent. And, back in April, he was running an ad that said, Tom Tillis has a proven record fighting against Obamacare. And then Tillis stopped Obama's Medicaid expansion cold. It's not happening in North Carolina, and it's because of Tom Tillis. In other words, you hundreds of thousands of people who work for a living in North Carolina, and you're working for one of those companies that is using the low-wage scam to subsidize your company, you are not going to get health insurance. You are not going to get Medicaid. That was back in April. Now, ask if he thought it would be likely that a state legislator expand Medicaid coverage after refusing to do so previously. Tillis said it might make some sense if the state had better control of financing the program. Right. I would encourage the state legislature and governor to consider it if they're completely convinced they now have the situation under control, Tillis said. Right. So when Republicans start losing elections, they start talking like Democrats, as Harry Truman pointed out over and over and over again. And then you got Don Young of Alaska telling school children they're to blame for a classmate's suicide. Really? This is just really strange stuff. Anyway, the Jordans in Frankfort, Kentucky.
Tom. How's it going, man?
Good.
Just wanted to take a little bit of issue with your assertion that the absence of a tax is a subsidy. Just because the government may choose to not tax something or make it tax deductible, doesn't make it a subsidy.
Okay, so if you go into if you go to Macy's and somebody comes up and says, "Here, would you like a free thing of cologne? You know, we'd like to you to try it out. Here's a free sample." Is that not some sort of a subsidy? I mean, aren't they giving you something?
They are giving me something, but that's Macy's giving me their own private property. I think really what the issue is you and I come from two different perspectives, because I believe that the government derives its authority from the governed. Therefore, it gets its property from the governed. So, you know, my private property is my private property. It's not the government's to choose to give to me if it wants. I think that's really where
we're at. What if the governed... I agree with you. The government derives its authority from the governed. I mean, that's laid out in the Declaration of Independence. And it's fairly clear in the Constitution. So when we, the people who decide what the government is going to do, and we, the people say, we, the governed say, we want the rich among us to be taxed at a higher rate than the poor among us. What's wrong with that?
I don't think that's the debate we're having, because I'm
okay. If we the people say we want churches to be taxed if they engage in political activity, what's wrong with that?
I'm a fan of democracy as much as you are, but that's not the debate we're having.
What's the debate we're having?
I think the center of the debate that we're having is whether choosing not to tax something is a subsidy. I'm not debating with you of whether the will of the people should reign. But I am debating about whether all property, I believe, is inherently private property. And, you know, the governed in this case may give up some of their private property for a government, but the government doesn't give up its property so that we can have private property. I think we're
actually the government does do that. The government holds property in trust for all of us, and some of it is where the government is functioning. But your argument, I just don't get your argument. How can it be that if I say, I mean, let me back up a little bit. I don't disagree that the property tax is one of the worst taxes there is, because what it means is that you can never actually own property. And if you fall on hard times and you can't pay your property taxes, then you lose your property. And in many cases, you lose your property for a fraction of what it's worth. You might have property that has a value of a couple $100,000. You could lose it over owing just $500 in taxes. You could lose it over owing $50 in taxes. And I think that that's wrong, morally. And I think that we need to have, a conversation about that. How do we fund government without property taxes? But that said, we have property taxes right now, and they do pay for local services, schools, fire departments, police departments, things like that. And so if somebody is saying, hey, I want to be exempt from paying those taxes, I want to be exempt from having to pay the cost of that part of government, and we, the people, collectively say, okay, fine, we'll give you that exemption. And this is what LBJ pushed into law in the 1960s. We will give you that exemption if you stick to religious activity and don't get involved in political activity. What's wrong with that?
I don't see anything wrong with that. But to go back to your Macy's example, you seem to think the situation is somebody's giving something away for free, a.k.a. when the government chooses not to tax me, they're giving me something. It's quite the contrary. It's as if I went into Macy's with a gun and said, here, Macy's, give me $5,000. They hand me over the money, and I say, oh, don't worry, I'm going to let you keep it. And I count that as a gift. That is the true.
I don't think your analogy or my analogy are particularly good. We should just stick with the actual case in point.
Maybe so. But I do think we fundamentally disagree.
Do you not agree that the child income tax credit is a subsidy? That if you have a child, you get to knock $3,000 or whatever it is nowadays. I have no idea. It's been a long time since I've...
Right. No, I don't believe that deductions or credits or any time the government chooses not to tax something is a subsidy. That them choosing not to take a little less of my private property is not them giving me something.
But you don't operate in a vacuum. You operate in a world where everybody else is also taxed. And so if you are getting a tax deduction for having a mortgage, for example, and paying mortgage interest, as opposed to renting, that seems to me unfair. If you are getting a deduction for having children in a time, in a world that's badly overpopulated, that seems to me like bad policy. But these are subsidies. How can they not be subsidies? If you're not having to pay taxes that other people have to pay. Therefore, you end up with more money that other people don't have.
Maybe the real issue is whether the taxes. The real issue is whether the absence of taxes is a subsidy or not. I believe that, my private property is my private property, and when the government chooses to take some via taxation, we all give.
But you're trying to throw things into an abstraction or into a vacuum, and we don't live or operate in a vacuum.
Somebody has to own all property. You believe that the government inherently owns all property, and I should be grateful.
No, I disagree with that. As I said earlier, I think that the property tax is the worst of all our taxes, and I would be very, very happy to see the property tax go away entirely.
What would be your what would you replace it with?
A wealth tax.
A wealth tax. Now there's your good socialist mind coming out.
You're right. And the wealth tax would not kick in until somebody's wealth was over $1 billion.
And I heard a little bit of your conversation earlier. That's not going to kill incentives.
No.
If you can't
live on $999 million, you got a problem.
No one lives on $999 million, Tom, themselves, but they choose to donate it to universities and give it to their children.
And they shouldn't. They shouldn't have to. We there was a time when our universities didn't need to live on donations. We appropriately funded them. Abe Lincoln started the land-grant colleges, giving over 50 universities across the United States enough land that they could work that land and give free tuition to people. Both Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln were big advocates of absolutely free education all across the country.
I'm not going to say that either one of those individuals were advocates for universally free education. Do you have quotes or anything to back that up?
Yeah, look at Thomas Jefferson's tombstone. He designed his own tombstone, and he chose to put on the tombstone, not that he was president of the United States for 8 years, but he was the author of the Virginia Resolution for Religious Freedom, that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, and that he was the founder of the University of Virginia, which is the first free public university in the United States.
I hardly think that is evidence that he was a proponent of universal free education. But anyway, we're kind of getting off topic.
Well, you can read his writings on it. I mean, he's it's not like I'm sharing my interpretation of history with you. It's unambiguous. Jefferson's belief.
Can I ask you one more question that I've been dying to know for a long time?
Sure.
You seem to have this infatuation with the commons. I want to know, from an economic standpoint, what are the bounds of the commons, people? What's part of the commons? What's not part of the commons? Give me some examples in your opinion.
That's a really good question. In my opinion, the commons are those things that we collectively own that have some role in life, liberty, or the pursuit of happiness. So I would say
everything.
Our roads, our air, air travel spaces. Frankly, I think that water and anything that is a natural monopoly, if there's only one thing coming into your house, it's not possible for it to be subject to competition, or at least it's complex. And so that either should be part of the commons that is owned by the government and thus administered by we the people for ourselves, like electricity and water and sewage, or that is heavily regulated so that it can be subject to competition. And it's very difficult to do that with water and sewage. It's easier to do that with electricity, and very easy to do that with the internet. So, you know, those are my philosophical boundaries. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
See, the net of all that is that even though I see all these problems with capitalism, I still think that both capitalism and free enterprise are useful things. You just have to make sure that they work. And welcome back, Rob in Buckeye, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to point out that there seems to be a little misconception, a little misunderstanding by specifically your previous guests and some of your callers about how tax exemptions of properties work for, say, a church.
Mm-hmm.
If that church is on a parcel of land in my town that I live in, that parcel is still being taxed, as property tax. The church just isn't paying it. That money is divided among all the other homes in that town.
My point.
And those people have to pay it.
Right. Right, my point.
So that, I'm agreeing with you. They don't seem to think that that's true.
Right, right. And
typically your guess.
Yeah, and that's the way that you said it is really a much more clear and coherent and articulate way of saying it than the way that I said it. So thank you for that, Rob. That's a good one.
Sure.
Actually that property is being taxed because that property is getting services. And it's just that all the rest of us are paying the taxes on it. And that's where I kept saying to Bishop Ned, Council Ned, that, if I'm going to pay for your church, I should have some say in it, right? Which is, as somebody else pointed out, the argument for if I'm going to pay for your welfare, I should have some say in it. Well, okay, we do that. We say we're going to have some say in it. Rob, thank you very much for the call. Well, well said. Norma, watching Free Speech TV in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. You keep talking about property tax. Most Americans do not keep up with how much American soil is sold every day to foreign investors, corporations, and foreign countries. Once it is sold, it's no longer American soil, and they do not pay property tax.
No, that's not true.
At least, here in Alabama, they don't.
No, it's not true, Norma. It only is not American soil if it's a consulate. If the Japanese government or if Sony Corporation probably a better example is Nissan or Mitsubishi or Lexus or whatever, if they build a factory on American soil and they own that property, they still pay property tax just as if it was Joe Blow down the street who owned it.
Not in Alabama.
Well, what Alabama is doing and what a lot of these, particularly the southern states, have done with these foreign corporations is they have granted them waivers from taxes, not because there's some law that requires it, but because they want them to locate their factory in Alabama rather than in Mississippi. And you get into
Correct.
These bidding wars between the states for these corporations. And this is This is something Bernie Sanders has spoken out on, and I think he is so right. And this is like one of the really big issues in America that is unaddressed. And that is what Bernie suggested, is that any time states engage in competition with each other for subsidies for corporations, those states should lose their federal highway tax dollars. In other words, they should be punished so that they don't do it. We need to put an end to this, you know, the ability of corporations, whether they're foreign corporations or domestic corporations, because Boeing just famously did the same thing, you know. And said, you know, we're going to move our headquarters out of Seattle. Which state or city is going to give us how many millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars to move to their place? And you had this bidding war that went off. And whether it's Boeing, which is an American company, or whether it's Mitsubishi, a Japanese company, that bidding war should not happen. But you're absolutely right, Norma. In Alabama, in probably the vast majority of corporate property, whether it's foreign-owned or not, is not taxed because they cut these deals. And it's a bizarre remnant of Reaganomics. Thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And Ellen Ratner is live at the White House. Hey, Ellen.
Well, thank you so much. The White House has said today that they don't have yet any readout, any comments on the Blackwater contractor convictions. So this was in Judge Lamberth's court. Now, Judge Lamberth was a Reagan appointee. Three are convicted on 13 counts of voluntary manslaughter and 17 counts of attempted manslaughter. They could do up to 30 years apiece. One was said to have been the first one to open fire, and he could spend the rest of his life in prison. 14 were unarmed and killed, 17 wounded. The shootings took place in September of 2007. Deliberations on this was 27 days.
Wow. Wow. That's substantial.
Okay.
Blackwater no longer exists. Does this have any impact on Mr. Prince's ongoing activities?
No, I don't actually think so. I think actually Mr. Prince has moved on to doing pretty decent things in Africa, believe it or not.
Well, he moved out of the United States.
Yes, they're definitely doing right, exactly. But I think he maybe got some religion or something. I don't know.
Interesting.
That's what I hear via my Africa grapevine. Okay, so as you know, in Ottawa, Canada, there have been three separate shootings done by either two to three gunmen. It's yet to be determined. The president has tried to make contact with Prime Minister Harper. All police buildings are on lockdown. The shootings took place at Parliament Hill, National War Memorial, near a shopping mall. The U.S. Embassy is also on lockdown in Ottawa, Canada. The president talked to the Australian prime minister today. They talked about Iraq. They talked about the Ebola epidemic. Now, Australia has given a lot of money for this. The president leaves very shortly, in a couple weeks after the election, for the G20 summit in Brisbane, Australia. So that is happening a lot. Now, also today, the CDC has issued new guidelines, and they have said that all people from Ebola-affected countries, this happened yesterday, have to go through five airports. But today they issued new guidelines saying that all people arriving from Ebola countries, it doesn't matter whether you're a journalist, a healthcare worker, or what, you have got to be monitored for 21 days. They're going to begin it in six states, Georgia, Maryland, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York, Virginia. Now, why D.C. wasn't involved, I haven't the foggiest.
Why these states? Because these are the places where you've got the airports?
People coming back from these countries are residing or involved in those three states somehow, in a big way.
Okay.
Senator Sanders today also came on the Social Security cost of living. He said he was disappointed by the announcement that only 1.7 increase in the cost of living for Social Security people and disabled veterans. As you know, he runs the Veterans Affairs Committee. You have brunch with Bernie all the time. But he said it's this one of the smallest increases since the automatic annual adjustments were adopted in 1975. There were no increase in benefits in 2000. 2010 and 2011. He said, as bad as that is, it could be a lot worse. He said many Republicans believe that these cost of living adjustments are too generous, but they want a significant cut Social Security by, of course, you and I have talked about this a lot. You're the world expert on it, on the chain CPI.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you.
So, okay, now we also have this incredible, I mean, I'll tell you, I don't normally talk about a lot of politics on this show. I try and give you Washington news, but I listened yesterday to the debate that happened between the current governor, Rick Scott, and Charlie Crist in Florida, and I have to say, in my 22 years covering politics, it was the meanest debate I have ever seen anywhere, anytime.
Really? Who was mean and how?
Well, they went after each other with how they were raised, whether they were raised with money, and they went after, I mean, both were mean to each other. Charlie mm-hmm. Crist went after the governor, saying that he got his money in a bad way, that he's on these fancy airplanes, these private aircraft. Then he went after Crist by saying that Crist was, you know, basically raised with a silver spoon in his mouth. But I mean, it was, the tone of it was beyond anything I have ever seen in my life. And that's a neck and neck race. There's also another race that had another debate yesterday, and that's Gene Shaheen and Scott Brown. Scott Brown, the former senator from Massachusetts, now in New Hampshire. It was originally not a close race at all. It has gotten to be much closer. I think Gene Shaheen will probably pull it out if people get out of their houses and vote. That was not as mean, although pretty dicey as well.
Although I understand that Scott Brown, he was asked, why didn't you just run for Senate in Massachusetts again? And he says, because I live here in New Hampshire. Yes. And everybody laughed.
Right. That's exactly what happened. So I think, honestly, if people get out of the House and vote, Shaheen wins. But, you know, nothing can be taken for granted in this particular season. The other thing that Scott Brown, when he went after Gene Shaheen and said she votes with the president 99% of the time, well, many Republicans vote with the president 90% of the time.
Right.
Huh. So it is really, I mean, we've got less than 2 weeks left, and as you know, a lot of these races are getting close, including even the governor's race in Massachusetts with a Republican.
Right.
So that's
very
that's
interesting.
Kind of where you have these races.
Yeah. Well, there's mind-boggling amounts of outside money coming in.
Yes, there are mind-boggling amounts of outside money coming in. Let's see, one other interesting thing, by the way, in terms of Canada, they are saying that things are still a bit sketchy in terms of news. He also would not talk, this is the press secretary, about what was going on in terms of ISIS, ISIL, and them getting some of these weapons. They said the vast majority of bundles did reach their target, and they got to the anti-ISIL group. So that's on that front. They also said, this is very interesting because he said it in a very clear way, more clear than I have heard the press secretary said it. He said the focal point now in Iraq and Syria is to build up the capacity of local fighters in Iraq and Syria and to back up with airstrikes.
Mm.
Now, whether that's going to do any good or not.
Yeah. I think that this is that whole region is just so badly broken by George Bush. It's a Humpty Dumpty.
But sure.
Anyhow, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
Always great to see you. We'll be right back.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And James Shirk is on the line with us, senior policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation in Labor Economics, heritage.org, the website. James, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Let's talk about the minimum wage here for a moment. There's this new report out suggesting that for folks who don't like subsidizing low-wage employees with six basic federal programs, the Earned Income Tax Credit, the Food Stamp Program, SNAP, the Section 8 housing vouchers, The TANT, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and Welfare Cash Assistance. People who don't like those programs, we can cut those programs by $7.6 billion a year, 45% of today's workers, by simply paying people $10.10 an hour, blowing up this business model that Walmart and McDonald's are using of, you know, they pay their employees so little that you and I have to pay our taxes to cover their living costs. What's wrong with that?
Well, the problem, as Jason Furman, who's now the chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, has pointed out, is that the existence of programs like food stamps, like Medicaid, like all the safety net programs you just mentioned, it actually causes Walmart and other employers of low-skilled workers to pay higher wages. So the existence of these programs is not so much a taxpayer subsidy to these companies. It actually slightly raises their costs. And the reason is because you have programs like this, it reduces the labor supply, translating that out of economic speak, that it makes it easier for people to get by without working a full-time job. And so more people do.
What country do you live in?
Same country Jason Furman lives in.
We have one of the loosest labor markets we've had since the 1920s.
Look, this is the fact is that the labor market the labor market would be such that
our labor market has collapsed over the last 34 years since Reaganomics was put into place. When Reagan came into office, the biggest employer in this country paid $54 an hour in today's dollars on average to its workers. It was General Motors. Today, the biggest employer in our country is paying less than $10 an hour on average. It's Walmart. We've seen a complete change in the way that we run our economy, and not only our household income down by 9% in real dollars since 1980, but it now takes 1.8 people to earn what one person used to earn. I mean, you look at 2.3 people. You look at household income, and you've got basically people working 2.3 jobs to do what one person used to do in 1980. How is that? You know, how is that a tight labor market? That looks to me like an incredibly loose labor market.
Well, again, what Jason Furman finds is that when you have more of these benefit programs, you enable people to drop out of the labor market. We've seen a huge drop in labor force.
But that's not what's happening.
Years.
People are dropping out of the labor market because there's no damn jobs.
Well, I mean, again, the question is, what is the effect of these programs on the margin? I mean, there's obviously the economy's been hit.
You're making, and let's take Jason Furman out of the equation. He's not here to defend himself or to explain what his positions are. You assert your position, I'll assert mine. The simple fact of the matter here is that the labor market is a function of the demand for labor versus the supply of labor, and as we have pursued neoliberal policies, the policies that Heritage advocates, free trade policies, for example, doing away with tariffs, these kinds of anti-protectionist policies, what we've seen is that the supply of labor has increased because a lot of the demand for labor has moved overseas.
Well, I think you're right. Certainly we agree that wages are going to be a result of the intersection between the supply and demand for labor. But what pretty much all the studies find is that programs, and again, there's good arguments for having these programs. We certainly need a safety net. But one of the consequences of the safety net is that you reduce the supply of labor.
No.
I mean, if you look at the labor force participation right now, even for prime age adults, it's incredibly low.
It's low because there's no jobs.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is you've got an enormous number of prime age people who are not in the labor force right now. That's practically the definition of reduced labor supply.
But see, I mean, okay, the assumption underlying all of your logic up to this point, if I have this right, James, is that if people have the option of getting goodies from the government, they will stop working. And I think that if you look at the history of this country, I mean, we had fairly generous benefits back during the 60s with the war on poverty, Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, that lasted solidly into the early 80s, and it didn't decrease workplace participation. In fact, we had one of the strongest workplaces in the world in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. And then Reaganomics hit us, and then in the 90s, you had Clintonomics with those free trade policies, which were really an extension of Reaganomics. And arguably, Nixon had kicked this off. You know, let's open the world to China. And you know, now, I mean, this is David Ricardo 101 on labor, 1807 was it? He published that. This is nothing new.
Well, I think you're, again, mistaken there on the amount we spent on welfare. I mean, the welfare state is substantially larger now than it was in the 1960s.
Only because our population is larger. Our population was half of what it is today in 1960.
Well, but in terms of, again, the overall amount, the number of programs, disability insurance is now covering roughly 6% of the adult population. Food stamps now cover far more. There's far more programs. We spent about $1 trillion on means-tested.
Because there's far more need. Back in the 60s, we had an economy that worked. Back in the 60s, you had people who, you know, with just a high school diploma, one person could raise an entire family, buy a house, take a vacation every year. At the end of 20, 30 years in the 40 years in the workplace, have some equity and a decent retirement. Now that's all out the window after 34 years of Reaganomics.
Well, you know, I'd encourage you to take a look at the Congressional Budget Office's data that they put together on household income. Listeners can simply Google CBO for Congressional Budget Office.
But when you do that, compare individual income too, because household income is highly deceptive. The average household back in the 1960s had a little more than one person working. The average household today has a little more than two people working.
No, that's right. And that's why one of the things you should look at, what I'd encourage your listeners to look at, would be, again, Google CBO distribution of household income and taxes, and then they've got some supplemental tables you can go on.
But it shouldn't be that way, should it? I mean, isn't the conservative position that you know, kids should be raised by at least one of their parents?
Let me finish here. What I was going to say, look at the income of non-elderly, so we're not dealing with people retired, and households without children. So we're, again, not so much dealing with the situation of two income instead of one income parents. So we're looking at non-elderly children and non-elderly households without children. And what you find is that since the late 70s, pretty much every single income quintile has seen their incomes go up over the past generation. What the CBO finds is that we are much better off. You know,
it's just that the top 1% has seen their income go up 348 times and not even percent times. And we've seen the average income, individual income of workers go down 9%.
Well, again, look at it's very interesting. What you find is that, yes, the folks at the top, average incomes have gone up across the board for non-elderly households and, again, without children. Same is true of the other groups, but this deals with your...
But when you exclude households with children, you're excluding a large cohort of the working population of America.
It's true of both non-elderly households with children and without children. I'm just trying to respond to your point about the fact that you've got a lot more two-income couples now than before. Let's take that out of the equation.
I see that as a bad thing.
It's true of both sets of data. What you see, though, is that the folks at the bottom, actually, the folks in the bottom quintile have seen their increase in market income. So not taxes, not government transfer programs, but market income has gone up by about 40% over the past generation. I consider that real progress. Look at the CBO's data. The numbers
over the past decade. What about the past 40 years? They're down 9%.
No, certainly. It was
since the Reagan presidency. Okay, James, we got to boogie out of here. James Shirk, you can read all about it. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
James Shirk, Senior Policy Analyst with Labor and Economics at the Heritage Foundation. Heritage.org is the website. James, thanks for dropping by.
All right, thank you.
Good talk. We'll be back. And welcome back. Randy in Onawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. What's up? Randy? Randy is listening to his TV instead of his telephone. Cliff in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Cliff, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Good day, Dr. Tom.
Hey, Cliff.
For good or bad, I'm going to tell you about an individual who have a big impact on our society. As you know, Vermont recently passed legislation requiring GMO foods to be labeled, and the governor signed it. Now, I think Maine and Connecticut are pretty close to doing the same thing in the East. There's states out here in the West that are also doing this. But there's an individual, his name's Congressman Mike Pompeo, P-O-M-P-E-O. He's from Kansas, the 4th District. And he is introducing a bill that would kill labeling at the it's a federal bill.
It's a federal bill that bans state.
Of all the states.
Right, it bans state labeling requirements.
Yeah, it's like a dream bill for the GMO industry because it would prohibit states from creating their own laws regarding the labeling. And what about all these people that are crying about states' rights?
Yeah.
Wouldn't this fall under their...
Republicans don't give a rat's ass about states' rights. It's a useful phrase to use when they're talking about things like guns or discrimination or voter suppression. But, the minute that rich people's interests are threatened by states' rights, Republicans run in the other direction.
Yeah, they pick and choose. Now, Tom, the GMA is the Grocery Manufacturers Association, and they spent over $54 million to defeat the initiatives in just Washington and California, those two states.
Right.
So if they're going to spend $54 million to defeat GMO labeling, what are they hiding? Why would they possibly spend that kind of money unless they're hiding something?
Right.
And one more thing, Tom, real quick. They put natural on packages of, chips and cookies and crackers all the time. And that natural is just a very deceptive marketing ploy to fool consumers.
Sure. Arsenic is natural.
Has nothing to do with organic or GMOs, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Look for the word organic, not the word natural, because pretty much anything that exists in nature is natural. And there's a lot of very poisonous things in nature.
Yeah. Petroleum's natural.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And here, drink this cup of gasoline. No, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. A good way to die.
All right, Tom, that's all I have today. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for the call, Cliff. Good to hear from you. We're going to hit a break here in about 40 seconds, so it wouldn't be fair to take another caller on. I did want to share with you, this was a conversation in 1982 with the White House press secretary, Reagan's White House press secretary. Question from a reporter. Does the president have any reaction to the announcement from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta that AIDS is now an epidemic? Reagan's press secretary. What's AIDS? Question from the reporter. Over a third of them have died. It's known as the gay plague. Laughter in the room. No, it is. I mean, it's a pretty serious thing that one in three people who get this have died, and I wonder if the president's aware of it. Larry speaks. I don't have it. Do you? Laughter in the room. Question from a reporter. In other words, the White House looks on this as a great joke. Larry speaks. No, I don't know anything about it, Lester. Question, does the president or does anybody in the White House know about this epidemic, Larry? Larry speaks. I don't think so. And then as they note in their pick of the moment over at the democraticunderground.com, Reagan didn't speak about the AIDS crisis until 5 years later, by which time more than 36,000 Americans were infected and more than 20,000 had died. You want to complain about Obama's response to Ebola? Welcome back, Tom. I'm here with you and Margie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hey, Margie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to point something out. Your previous guest cited that 6% of the adult population are currently receiving disability benefits. There's a very good reason for the increase in disability benefits. It's because medical treatment has progressed so far that people who, say, had a car accident would have died.
Oh, yeah. It's the same reason why we have more disabled veterans.
And same reason why we have more disabled children, because the treatment of premature babies has improved. Right. So if anybody ever throws that statistic at you again, please ask them. Would they rather that those people just died, or should they actually receive medical treatment so they can live?
Thank you for that, Margie, because that was one of the things where I just didn't have a reply. And certainly, when a conservative says, oh, look at how there's more people on disability than there used to be, first thought everybody has is, oh, fraud. And no, you're absolutely right. This is why we have all these soldiers coming back with one, without legs, with blinded, whatever.
Right.
And as you correctly point out, they would have in previous wars, they would have simply died on the battlefield. And the same thing, our cars, you get a car crash of 40 miles an hour. If that had happened in the 1960s without a seatbelt, everybody's dead. Now you just have some injuries, and some of those injuries can be lifelong disabilities. Margie, thank you for the call. Brilliant. Janet in Hinesville, Georgia. Hey, Janet, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's actually Danette with a D. I am calling for two reasons. One, the pastor that you had on in the 1 o'clock hour was talking about render unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
Right.
And that is actually what the Bible says. I am a Christian, and it really burns me up when Christians want to impose their worldview on others. And it's merely a problem of them not knowing and understanding the Constitution, you know. And so I think that that is a problem within the church, where there's not a balance between knowing the Bible and knowing the Constitution.
Yeah. And just for people who don't know what we're talking about, there is a scene in, I believe it's in Matthew, it might be in Luke, where a fellow comes up to Jesus. In fact, I want to say a centurion, but anyhow, somebody comes up to Jesus and says, should I pay my taxes? And Jesus, you know, I'm a follower of yours. Should I pay my taxes? And Jesus says, whose picture's on the coin that you have, on the money that you have? And the guy says, Caesar's. And Jesus says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and render unto God what is God's. And
exactly.
Yeah, so there we go.
Yeah, and then that goes for same-sex marriage. That goes for the right to choose, you know, a woman's right to choose. That's also, you know, part of the constitutional amendments. And so that, to me, just, I get really frustrated with my brethren because they don't understand that. Like, they just don't get it.
Yeah.
The other thing is that you had the guest on from the Heritage Foundation citing non-elderly adults without children. Of course, non-elderly adults without children will have income increases that will not, you know, they'll live way better than people. And I know that that was not grammatically correct, but they will live considerably better than people with children. When you have children, you have expenses that go along with having children.
Right.
So for, you know, I was a single mother with two children, and there is no way, unless that man for himself was living on TANF, and at the time before Clinton changed it, it was AFDC and food stamps. Before you are living on welfare and food stamps, I get so sick of people saying that we choose that.
Right.
You cannot survive on that.
No, I agree. And that's why, you know,
it is,
and I just point to the history of this country. If you look at every time our labor market has tightened up, every time there's lots of job opportunities out there, the number of people who are on welfare goes down. It goes down substantially. And when the job market loosens up, when there are no jobs to be found, the number of people on welfare goes up. And it's not because they don't want to work. It's because there is no work. And it just this conservative canard that people choose to sit around on welfare and eat bonbons and watch television is just nonsense. And the proof of that is the times that we have relatively full employment. Janet, thank you. Excellent points, both. Vince in San Jose, California. Hey, Vince, what's up?
Hi, Tom. The frustrating thing for me, listening to these knuckleheads calling in saying my church is not being subsidized, is the question is not being asked. When your church catches fire, who the hell comes down there and puts it out? Are they local parishioners coming in, or is our socialized fire department putting it out?
Right.
The people that are making the argument that's not a subsidy are crazy. They're not listening.
I'm not sure I'd characterize people as crazy, but I would say that they're trying to avoid acknowledging a simple reality, which is that we subsidize churches in the United States, and if we by giving them tax exemptions, and there's all kinds of things that we subsidize. We sit around and say, okay, what's really important for us to have? Well, it's really important for us to have libraries. Okay, we'll make them tax exempt. Or it's really important for us to have schools. So if somebody starts a school, they can start as a tax exempt. Hospitals, tax exempt. We're going to subsidize these things. I'm not sure that it's really important to us to have churches.
Well, that's the whole point, though, is that they're saying that they're not being subsidized, and it's so blatantly obvious they are.
Yeah.
I mean, with regard to, you know, many other types of things that they're getting. It's sick to me, and I don't know if it's sick, and crazy is obviously a little bit extreme a word, but
I get so frustrated when I hear people say, you know, my church doesn't take anything from anybody.
Right.
Baloney.
Well, it's just like conservatives who say, you know, I pulled myself up by my own bootstraps. Everything I've got, I earned. You know, come on. If you live in any country, you know, that has any kind of infrastructure at all, then you got where you are as a result of society, not just yourself. You know, you leave, you know, very accomplished, but still society helped. Vince, excellent point. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Reagan would not mention the word AIDS until 20,000 Americans have died of AIDS. And they're criticizing Obama on Ebola? It's your media support group for We the People. Talk media for the sane among us. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. And other slogans of the day. Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Your guests from the Heritage use this tiny sliver of, you know, of our economy, you know, childless couples.
Right.
As a
non-elderly childless. I'm not even sure it was couples. It might have been individuals. It was households, and a household can be one person.
Well, those are the people that have the much more time to spend on, like, advancing their career. Hmm. Or, I mean, that you can't. I don't know how we could use that as an indicator of our economy. It's such a tiny sliver anyway. And
I agree.
It's going to be skewed. It's going to be skewed because these are the people that are going to be using more of their time and money to advance their career. They're going to make more money.
Right. And there are those among us who have children, and there are those among us who are elderly. And I don't think that any discussion of our economy should start out by saying, we're going to exclude a bunch of these people from this conversation.
Right. Yeah, I also, I don't, the thing about poor people, I just want to say one thing about that, about how we subsidize poor people, therefore we should be able to control their actions.
Right.
Well, poor people pay taxes too.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the same thing at all.
Yeah, and
because the people are not tax exempt. That's kind of like corporations are people type of argument.
Yeah, it could be.
People are people.
Yeah, but I think that the principle that if we as a country collectively or as a people are going to offer some sort of subsidy, we extract in exchange for that the behavior that we want is a solid principle. It's you know, for example, we want people to own houses, or at least after World War II, we wanted people to own houses. So we said, we'll subsidize that. We'll give you a tax deduction on interest, mortgage interest. We wanted, up until the 80s, we wanted people to have credit cards. They were this new invention, and it was like, you know, I don't know if we wanted it, but certainly the banksters wanted it. They lobbied Congress and they got it. And up until the 80s, you could deduct your credit card interest from your taxes. And then,
But we start talking about controlling poor people because we subsidize them, because we give them money for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I mean, we could be talking about anybody because we all enjoy some sort of tax subsidy.
Right, and we all enjoy them within the constraints that society, that government, that we the people have imposed. In other words, you're only eligible for the child tax credit if you have children. You're only eligible for the mortgage interest deduction if you have, you know, a mortgage. You're only eligible for a charitable contribution if you give money to charity. So you've got to engage in these behaviors that we desire, or that, you know, that we want to promote if you're going to get the benefits that we're offering. So,
right.
You know,
it's kind of murky. It makes me uncomfortable.
It is, but it's and the way it gets used by, you know, in a punitive way, in particular by many of these southern governors, you know, oh, you want welfare benefits, you have to pee in the cup. You know, you want to vote, you have to get to ID, whatever it may be. The way that it's used by the vote is bad. Actually, it shouldn't be part of this conversation. But the way that this is used punitively makes me cringe. That said,
right,
though, I think that the principle is a reasonable principle, that we the people, you know, if somebody is you know, generating income independent of government, which I think we all acknowledge is at a certain point a specious argument, but you know, somebody has specific income, they have a little more say in how that income can be used than if they're getting income as a consequence of we the people giving it to them directly. And I realize that this is, you know, a Rush Limbaugh Republican talking point, but there's some truth to it.
But poor people pay taxes too, so they're
part, I agree
of
with that,
the people.
Yes, and I'm not saying that poor people don't pay taxes, and you know they pay in particular sales tax and the every single penny that they earn, and most poor people, by the way, in the United States are working, and every penny that they earn is taxed with the because they're by definition they're making less than $118,000 a year, so they are paying, you know, Social Security taxes, what they call payroll tax on every penny. Yeah, good point, Anita. I got to move along. Thank you for the call. James in Spokane. Hey, James, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing today, Tom? It's good to talk with you. These people talking about welfare queens and the few people who game the systems. Yeah. If we disallow anything because some people endeavor to game it, you know, what's left? You know,
well, they use that logic to try and do away with welfare, and now they're using that logic to try and do away with voting. Somebody might vote fraudulently, so we have to, you know, two people voted fraudulently in 10 years in Texas, so we're going to knock 600,000 people off the voting rolls.
Yeah, when it's convenient for them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
A couple weeks ago, we were speaking about pride, and I don't know if you remember or not. And you said maybe our differences in thought were semantic or syntactic or whatever. I think it's pragmatic. I think oftentimes when people say pride, they mean dignity. And there's a big difference. I mean, to me,
there is.
It's a poor substitute for dignity. Pride can be immoral or immoral, and dignity can only be moral, in my judgment.
That's a very interesting analysis. Let me ponder that. I don't have a glib response.
One more thought, Tom.
Hmm?
You're often talking about the philosophies, the socialist philosophies of the 30s.
Right.
We have to remember we're at the negative place we are today. Because it was followed by an influx of fascist Nazi influence before, during, and more importantly, after our war, we purposefully allowed war criminals to enter the U.S. and even into upper echelons of governmental power.
Yeah, yeah. There were a bunch of Nazis who came in and into the CIA and other places, and of course into the nuclear programs. I agree. That said, though, that I think is more responsible for our national security state. And for this perpetual, you know, this monster that has been created that Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, than it is
the general zeitgeist.
Yeah.
The general zeitgeist too much is in the war on drugs.
Yeah, yeah. I don't disagree. But you know, it's also that worldview that drove the Nazis is the conservative worldview. It's the authoritarian worldview. And so whether you get Nazis or not, you're going to have authoritarians in your society, and you're going to have, you know, people who are trying to game the system in your society.
So. And justifying the means.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think we need Nazis for that. James, thanks for the call. Lane in Blairsville, Georgia. Hey, Lane, socialism and state-run capitalism?
Or socialism. I'm just catching a little bit of your show, and that Heritage guy, a huge socialist, but you didn't flinch, and you agreed with him. And I thought that was awesome. But... How can we do that to people, and how, compare that to being a progressive?
I'm missing something here, Lane. What is the huge misconception that you're talking about?
Well, the conservatives use the S word socialism and the C word communism against us, and usually that's to shut down the conversation.
Right.
That's the best. Don't want to be socialist. You don't want to be communist. I heard a talk. A guy said that the problem with the Soviet Union is that it's state-run capitalism. Is that true? And how did socialism play a role in the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Right.
So how do you defend socialism?
I think you need to make a distinction between socialism and communism. And I realize that, Marx used the words in a fairly interchangeable way. And certainly the Soviet Union used them in an absolutely interchangeable way. But the citizens of Northern Europe beg to differ, who all refer to themselves as socialist. Angela Merkel is the head of the Christian Socialist Party. The government of France is, you know, the president of France is a socialist. The governments of all the Scandinavian countries define themselves as democratic socialist governments. So, you know, number one, let's split these apart. Communism is the state basically owns everything and the means of production and supply, and the individual owns very, very little. And I don't think, you know, I think communism works well in small societies. Communism works well in kibbutzes. Communism works well for tribal people where everybody pools their resources. Communism worked well for Jesus and his 12 disciples. They had the common purse. It was a little communist society, a communist cell. Jesus was one of the earliest communists, I guess you could say. But once your society reaches the point where people can act anonymously, then which is more than 150 or 200 people, basically, because that's about all that any one individual can keep track of, is about 150 people. Once your society grows beyond those sizes, then, you know, you have a society that doesn't, you know, communism doesn't work. Socialism, on the other hand, where we're saying we're going to define those things that are part of the commons, and we're going to define certain rights, certain basic baselines for life that we think the government should be responsible for providing. Education, health care, transportation, or at least the access to transportation, housing, a job. These are things that at various times in the history of the United States, we have asserted are actually human rights. So the whole New Deal, government will be the employer of last resort. We've lost that. It's gone away. But it was a really, really strong thing that drove up wages and helped build the middle class in America. That's arguably socialism. And so I would say, you know, Bernie Sanders says, I'm a democratic socialist. I would say I'm a democratic socialist, but I'm not a communist at all. So, Lane, thank you for the call. I think it's time for us to reclaim some of this language and look at the possibility, not the possibility, the reality, that socialism, when it's regulated, just like capitalism when it's regulated, can actually be a positive thing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The devil, of course, is in the details. How do you regulate it? We have in the United States intense socialism for our corporations, particularly tobacco and oil. And welcome back. Well, this should be entertaining. Larry, watching Free Speech TV in New Paltz, New York. It says here, you disagree with everything I say. Really?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
But a good deal of it, yes. My main problem is I've worked hard all my life, two or three jobs. I didn't ask for anything else, but give me a job. And I work 16 hours a day on average. And I'm self-employed most of my life as a carpenter, and very glad to do it. I served my four years in the service, years ago in the Korean time period, and I just think there's too much whining about what race you are, what this and that, and everybody got their hand out. I'm getting subsidies right now from the government because of all the years I put in to earn Social Security and one thing or another. I also, when I was working self-employed, I hired people and paid for their Social Security, the benefits, and unemployment tax, and the date tax, and the MTA tax for the subway in New York City, which I've never been on in my life. But we still got, in New York, you get taxed for everything. But I think it's too much whining, and who gets what and why.
Well, then stop whining, Larry.
I'm sorry?
If there's too much whining, stop whining.
It's not whining?
No, I said stop whining.
Oh, I'm whining?
It sounds like it.
If that's what I'm doing.
Sounds like you're whining about people who are whining.
Well, hey, there might be truth there. You're absolutely right. I'm just tired of listening to it.
No, well, I understand. Let me just raise it. Larry, if you were part of the generation that went to Korea, did you have GI Bill benefits when you came back?
Yes, I used for buying houses. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So do you realize that, and my dad did too. My dad, the first house that he bought, in fact, the first and second houses that he bought with on the GI Bill, and you know, sold one to get the other. Did you know that African Americans who came back from World War II in Korea who tried to use their GI benefits to buy houses were explicitly denied access to GI Bill benefits? This was one of the...
If that's the case, if that's the case, then friends of mine that worked in construction that had their own house and were black must have been way above their situation then. They must not
have
realized
how bad they probably were. Paid more for their house than you did. You got subsidized and they didn't.
I don't know if I got subsidized.
Well, sure you did. The GI Bill was a subsidy. You took welfare.
It's like going to the bank. I used the banks with the GI Bill backing it up, yes.
Right, yeah. So,
I still paid the monthly payment.
So, Larry, you're a welfare queen. You're a welfare queen. You took GI Bill money.
I earned it. I'm talking about people that earn something is different than the people that just whine to get it because their great-great-grandfather was a slave. That's bullcrap.
Yeah.
Grow up.
But to say that their father couldn't buy a house that Larry could buy,
I'm part Indian.
That's not bullcrap.
I'm part Indian also, so I could claim all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Larry, thank you. I get it. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back, Tom Harmon here with you, Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Oh, hi. Well, I think you. Your previous caller, he illustrated the one who complained about people whining. He illustrated that the language you use matters. I mean, he said that he was being compensated for the work he did rather than being subsidized. Anyway, you the one previous caller, the other previous caller who sounded like Grover Norquist, who was complaining who was saying that you were not subsidizing a church by not taxing them. You know, when actually you had it right the first time, well, the rest of the taxpayers are subsidizing that church.
Right.
And then he's saying that he's calling taxes, a gun put to his head, taking his property, taking his private property, when actually it's his legitimate obligation to pay his fair share for commonly held property or paying for people who are disabled or paying for people who are undercompensated. We are not subsidizing the poor. We are subsidizing their employers. These people are either undercompensated or they are disabled or there is not a shortage of workers. People say that people are collecting welfare, there is an incentive not to work. Well, as though there were a great shortage of workers. There's not a shortage of workers. There's anything but there's a shortage of jobs. So I think, language is it's all about the way you use language is the way you can stretch a point beyond credulity,
Yeah, excellent point. We need to be very, very careful and forceful in the language that we use. Thank you, Mark. Jim in Littleton, Colorado. Hey, Jim.
Yeah, since we're talking about taxes today, I'll stick with that. I was wondering about what about a carbon tax on gasoline instead of taxing the corporations, which will just pass it on to us anyways. Why don't we just put 100% tax on gasoline?
Well, I think that what we should do is we should follow a very simple principle, and that is that when there are costs to society from the use of a product, we recover those costs. If a chemical company produces a waste and they dump it into a Superfund site, up until the Bush administration, it used to be the government could go and say, okay, this waste that you put here is going to cost us $10 million to remediate, to fix. Give us $10 million. Right? The corporations used to have to pay a Superfund fee. So the question then becomes, what is the cost of carbon? When we use carbon, what does it actually cost society? In actual real dollars, as opposed to just moral issues and things. And
I heard $13 a gallon on a documentary that did it on gasoline.
Yeah, if you look at carbon per ton, the cost to society is somewhere between, and there's people who can calculate these numbers a variety of ways, and particularly whether or not you're including global warming, somewhere between $20 a ton, which does not include global warming. That's just the cost of the asthmas and cancers and the cost of and it really doesn't even include the cost of the fifth fleet to protect the shipping lanes from Saudi Arabia. But it's either $20 or it's about $120 per ton. And there's a lot of rational people who say, Ireland, when they rolled out a carbon tax, they started at $15 a ton. And this is just a starting point. But as even a $15 or $20 a ton, what that does, and you make it on all sources of carbon, natural gas, coal, oil, any of them. And when you do that, then A, you're recovering those costs, but B, suddenly, I mean, instantly, solar and wind become more economical than fossil fuels, which is something that we have to do really fast. So I'm totally with you. If you go to greenworldrising.com, we did an entire video on this that Leonardo DiCaprio narrated, and it's a very, very important point. Jim, thank you for the call. Dana in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Dana, what's up?
I just wanted to bring up, you were talking earlier, last hour, I think, about monasteries should be the only ones exempt from paying taxes if we tax religions, churches, et cetera.
In my opinion.
Because they don't make any money. Well, okay. They do. And the one I'm most familiar with is the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky, Trappist monks. They sell fudge, cheese, what else? They sell a variety of things.
Yeah.
Also, there was a monastery up here in Wisconsin that became famous because they were selling laser ink, and they called them, I think, the Laser Brothers or something like that. But anyway, monasteries do make money in a variety of ways, mostly to support themselves.
Right.
But I suppose if they make a profit, it goes to the mother house or the father house or whatever. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
So
interesting point.
I also wanted, if I could bring up one old point from a few weeks ago. You were talking about the killings at Jackson State and why they never got – and why people didn't know about them. One reason, I think, was because it was African-American students who were killed, and we don't pay as much attention to bad things that happen to African-American kids. But the other was it happened just a few days after the killings at Kent State University in Ohio. And
where white kids got killed.
Pardon me?
Where white kids got killed.
Exactly. But also, I think it just got subsumed in the Kent State story, and that's why people don't know about Jackson State. I went to Kent State, so I make it a point every time I talk about the killings to talk about Jackson State as well. But, you know, that's my one little one-woman campaign.
There you go. Dana, I'm with you. Thank you very much for the call. Excellent point. Marvin, we have a minute left. Marvin in Sacramento, you're on the air.
Okay, real quick about the minimum wage. Thanks for taking my call, by the way.
Sure.
Minimum wage should be based on cost of living on the state that you live in or the town that you live in, because I can buy an avocado here cheaper in California than I can where my in-laws live at in Oregon. It costs three times as much for an avocado in Oregon as it does in California. And if you get a gallon of milk in California, my God, if you buy and try to buy a gallon of milk, I mean,
right. On the other hand, housing is more expensive in California than Oregon, even though food may be cheaper. I mean, but I don't disagree. I think that, in fact, what I think we should do at the national level is define what is the minimum amount of money that a family needs to basically function as a functional family, and set that as the minimum wage, with the ideal being that a single wage earner should be able to support a family. And then state and local governments can go above that if they want, which is pretty much how it is right now, except that all the numbers are way too low. Marvin, thank you for the call. You're spot on. In fact, what you're saying, Marvin, is what Teddy Roosevelt said in his Square Deal speech back in 1912, I think it was. And it's really worth listening to that. We play it here every 6 months or so. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.